Support for the Pitch Talks podcast comes from the good beer folks at Steam Whistle, makers of Canada's premium Pilsner. Why not stop by the brewery right outside the Rogers Centre for a sample or a six-pack? Steam Whistle. Do one thing really, really well. Hey people, welcome to Pitch Talks. This time on the podcast, it's the Pitch Talks Book Club. You've heard of Oprah's Book Club? Well, ours has 100% more baseball and 100% less Oprah. We're talking baseball books today on Pitch Talks. Baseball is said to be a writer's game. There's a lot of wide open space to fill in between the action, whether you're at the ballpark, watching on TV, or listening on the radio. Now, do people still listen to the games on the radio? I friggin' hope so. Check out a Dodgers game online, and if Vin Scully can't make you fall in love with the game, well, there is no hope for you. Baseball has an inherent rhythm that gives you time to dissect, mull over, and kind of anticipate each play. Second-guessing and kicking around each manager's decision and umpire's call is almost a sport of its own. When it comes to books on sports, no other sport is better suited for detailed, thoughtful consideration than baseball. Today on Pitch Talks, we're going to take a look at some of our favorite authors that we've had on the live show. Jesse Goldberg Strassler has got some baseball terms and tales. John Kearney has a very specific look at a very specific stat. And Jonah Carey writes what he knows, and he knows the Expos. Meantime, ESPN's Ken Rosenthal does have a book in him, but it might be a while.
Hopefully one day before I'm 100 years old, if I get that live that long, I'll write a book and I'll tell all the stories. And there are some really good ones, yeah. But I can't do it right now.
To break it down to basics, you're going to need to use your words, as my friends like to tell their young kids. Well, first up to bat today on the podcast, we're going to hear from the man that wrote the book on baseball words. Literally. The Baseball Thesaurus by Jesse Goldberg Strassler is full of baseball words and crazy stories, some of which you might be familiar with, but many more that you probably won't be. Need a baker's dozen words for a fly ball? This book is for you. During his day job as the play-by-play man for the Lansing Lugnuts, the Blue Jays single-A minor league affiliate, Jesse has to paint a picture almost daily using only his words. Now, in the context of baseball, have you ever heard of a Linda Ronstadt or dump trucking? If not, this segment is dedicated to you. Not as big a fan as you thought you were, eh? We got a hold of Jesse all the way at his home in Lansing, Michigan. Here he is with the word on baseball.
Hello, this is Jesse.
My name is Jesse Goldberg Strassler, and baseball and I are in a committed long-term relationship. I am the radio broadcaster of the Lansing Lugnuts, Class Single-A affiliate for the Toronto Blue Jays.
Now, my first question is, what was the goal with writing the book?
The goal was that I needed it. It was 2005. It was my first job out of college with the Brockton Rocks, an independent league team out in Brockton, Massachusetts, south of Boston. And I was using all the same words to describe very different things over the course of a baseball game. So whenever a ball was hit hard, I'd always say the batter hammered it. Or whenever the pitcher threw it, I'd say the same thing. Or whenever a player was running around the bases, I'd describe him the same way. And that's not accurate. That's not vivid. That's not what's actually going on. The way one player runs around the bases is different from another. The way each ball is struck is different. So I wasn't actually describing what was happening. I'd gotten myself into a rut. So I needed a book like this, and I looked around, and nobody else had written it.
What are some of your favorite words from the book, and why?
My favorite words that might be in it, they're my favorites because I first heard them outside of it. And I'll give you an example. Drew Hutchison, now in the Blue Jays rotation. He was a non-prospect when he first established himself with the Lansing Lugnuts some years back. And everybody said about him, now, I know you don't know too much about him. High school guy drafted out of Florida, but he's got a dead fish changeup. And that's what I thought of. Every time he threw that changeup, I pictured, here comes the old dead fish. and it would die right out of his hands and stink its way up to home plate with the batter off balance. And so that suddenly became a word that I loved. I loved that phrase. There are other things too. Steaks. Pat Henkin dropped by the Lugnuts clubhouse and was talking about, hey, who's eating all the steaks around here? And what he's talking about is steaks are ribeyes. Ribeyes are RBIs. So the leadoff hitter sets the table, and that way the big hitters can go eat. What do you eat? You eat steak. Every year, every month, I hear different phrases from guys, and that just brings it to life. I love it. Ryan Goins, I remember he and Sean Ochinco, when they were with the Lugnuts, they loved to call home runs tacos, and I'd never heard that before. And if a guy hit it to the opposite field, it was an oppo taco. And now I guess that's a much more casual and heard of phrase in baseball language, but at the time, since I had never heard it, that stuck. And now every time I see that opposite field home run, I'm thinking oppo taco. It's that usage that brings it to life.
What are some of the new words that you found out since you published the book that you wish you could have included in the last pressing?
I'd never heard of a one flapper or two flapper after the first edition. And when the book was being brought around, there was a media member in Lake County, Ohio, near Cleveland. And he said, how about all those two flappers out there? And what he meant was, in the major leagues, your batting helmet might have zero flaps or one flap. But in the minor leagues, that batting helmet always has two ear flaps for the right-hander, for the left-hander, whoever needs it. And I'd never heard that way of describing a minor leaguer compared to a major leaguer. That comes to mind. There's also the idea that a base runner can dump truck his way around the base paths. I think I heard Travis Snyder use that once to describe he's dump trucking his way around second. Those are the first two that probably come to mind.
Have you heard from any play-by-play guys, and has the book come in handy for them?
It's funny. It's on the shelf in the Cleveland Indians broadcast booth, and I went to visit them. And there it is. There it is, right behind the broadcasters on their nice bookshelf. And I've sent it around, too. Dan Dickerson with the Detroit Tigers gave me terrific feedback. Pat Hughes with the Chicago Cubs also. Very supportive. That's the best thing. Just hearing from person after person after person, whatever use they've gotten out of it. For me, I was just looking for words. But in tossing in all of those little stories, the fact that the National League considered putting in the DH before the American League, or at the very least right with the American League, the fact that a pizza party was held at the first All-Star game, and more, that the Dodgers, the Yankees, and the Giants played what amounted to a triple threat game during World War II, all of these little stories that I inserted in to help flesh out the language, that's what I've heard from different broadcasters, that they now have these anecdotes that they can spice up their broadcasts with. People have been great.
I've got a quick quiz for you. Can you give me five other names for a baseball in 5 seconds?
All right, here we go. You ready? Let's see. Orb, apple, let's say a rock, horse-eyed. And then as I'm drawing a blank because of that 5 seconds, I'm thinking about all those other things. A pearl is a baseball before it gets rubbed up with the Lena Blackburn rubbing mud, and I believe I flunked.
I've picked six of my favorites, and I want to see if you can remember what they mean.
Okay, we'll do our best. The fun thing is, I got this book for me, not because I'm an expert with it, but because I need to learn this. But bring it!
I want to think that these are so memorable that you wouldn't forget, but who knows? Okay, a pea patch.
Tearing up the pea patch was Red Barber's phrase whenever the Brooklyn Dodgers started crushing it.
Donkey.
So I would say that would be a big, powerful slugger.
It's an inexperienced player.
That's right. Goodness, yes.
Okay. Do you know what a peacherino is?
Was that a terrific highlight reel play?
It is. Nice. Good one.
That play was a peacherino. That comes from the 19th century, I believe. What a peach. What a peacherino.
This one's probably one of my favorites. Can you tell me what a Linda Ronstadt is?
Yes, the Blue Bayou. Linda Ronstadt's a fastball. because that fastball blew by you.
How about a screaming memo?
Screaming Mimi, I believe, too. That's a line drive. That's a sizzler. That's a frozen rope, a clothesline.
And finally, can you tell me what a dog robber is?
A dog robber. Whew, that wouldn't be an umpire, would it?
It would be an umpire. Very good.
It sounds like an umpire, doesn't it? As I was going through the phrases for umpires and what we called umpires, I found very few that weren't insulting.
I'm planning on ending this interview with a real bang, like something very excited just happened. What words should I try to work in?
You say it's with a bang, and I have to say that I might disappoint you. Because you have to be organic. You have to say whatever comes to your mind first. That's why, for example, a couple of famous broadcasters would say, "Oh, doctor," or you'd hear a "holy cow," or whatever it might be. Dick Enberg's "oh my." You've got to figure out some way to say it. My favorite way, and I forget which broadcaster I picked this up from, is "you wouldn't believe it." Right? Because if you're sitting there at home, I'm the one who saw it. You didn't see it. You wouldn't believe it.
I think I'm just going to have to stick with "that's all, folks."
Well, that'll work.
Up next on the Pitch Talks Book Club, do you consider yourself a stats nerd? Are you able to enjoy dissecting the box score as much as you are watching the actual game? John Carney recently wrote a book called Immaculate, The History of Perfect Innings in Baseball, and he took to the stage at Pitch Talks in Hamilton, Ontario, along with Sportsnet's Stephen Brunt, who's got a book or two under his belt, to tell us all about it.
Let's talk about, first of all, how you define a perfect inning, because there's a lot of ways you could define it, I guess, but yours is very specific. Talk about how you came to that.
So a perfect inning is a 9-strike inning, so all 3 batters retired in order on 9 pitches. That's perfect.
But it could be 3 outs, it could be a 3-pitch inning too, but why did you decide that that was kind of the that was perfection?
We thought a lot about a 3-pitch inning. I think the distinction is, with a 3-pitch inning, you would have to have somebody else on the team make a play. There'd have to be an out in the infield or the outfield. There'd have to be other players involved. If you think about an immaculate inning, it's really the pitcher, the catcher, and the batter. And I think that's why it has the definition of being an immaculate pitching feat.
You know, what was kind of the essence of it? What did you think was going to be the significance of an immaculate inning?
Well, you know, I think I should go back and date where the inspiration for the book came from,
okay,
actually. And I can date it. It was July 31st, 2013, and I was on my way home from Hamilton to Niagara, which is where I live, and I was listening to a radio station, you may have heard of it, it's called the Fan 590, they were talking about Steve Delabar's immaculate inning, and you remember Steve Delabar had a heck of a 2013,
yep.
And when I heard it, I thought, I've actually never heard of that term before. I'd never heard of immaculate. I've heard of perfect games. I've heard of no-hitters. So the first thing I did is I went home and I started to do some research. And I thought, maybe this is really fairly common. And the first thing I discovered was it's not. So the book ends at the end of the 2014 season, but it goes back to 1889. There's only been 73 pitchers who've pitched an immaculate inning. Compared to, let's say, perfect game, where there's 23 pitchers in the history of the game. No-hitters are a little bit more common. But really, when you think about the number of innings that are played in professional baseball since 1889, I mean, that's infinitesimally small in terms of a percentage or proportion.
Tell me how you began the search for those immaculate innings.
Yeah, it's not easy. So, I mean, the first place I went, most online sources are always a good place to begin. It was a lot of online research going back and trying to find newspaper clippings, anything you could, because you can't always ascertain from a box score whether it was a perfect inning. So it's really, from a research perspective, we cross-tabulating information across a number of different sources. For me, it was a chance to go through the archives, and I know you've done this work before. Mm-hmm. It's fun, especially when you go back in time. And, you know, I mean, it was very, very easy to make it about, or it could have been very, very easy to make it all about the numbers. It could have been a nice short article that was just a stats piece. But I really wanted to tell the stories of the pitchers, and that's the real main focus of the book.
Aside from the fact that, you know, it's 9 pitches, is there any other commonality among these things?
Yeah, so, one of the first things I did was, and that's really the first chapter of the book, was get into the numbers and start to do some analyses. So the first thing I thought, maybe I plotted it over time and looked at the trend. You have a period of time from the 20s, late 20s to 50s, 1953 to be precise, where there's no immaculate innings at all. You have very, very few instances of it during the dead ball era. And then you've got this long gap after World War II into the 1950s. But then when you get to the 2000s, obviously, you see a big spike. So the first thought was, well, this is just increased pitching specialization. These are relievers. This is, you know, this is what's driving it. So I went back and I went looked at by inning and basically plotted the proportion of times it occurs in an inning. And what I found was about 36% of the time it occurs in inning 7, 8, or 9. But that means 74% of the time it's somewhere else in the game. And it's almost never in extra innings. So the next thing I did was, you know, I'm really getting geeky research here, but I looked at the correlation between...
It's probably the right crowd for that, I just got to tell you.
Yeah, I think I'm safe. Yeah. Yeah. I looked at the correlation between when the inning occurred, what inning, and what year, and it's flat. So there's, I mean, so what we say in research is there's no association whatsoever. I kind of like that. It keeps it mysterious. I don't really know why we're seeing more of it. Let's talk about the four pitchers who've pitched more than one immaculate inning, right? Randy Johnson, just got admitted. Nolan Ryan, right? A guy named Lefty Grove. Anybody know who Lefty Grove was? Yeah, pitcher from the 1920s, Hall of Fame pitcher. And then Sandy Koufax. And Sandy Koufax is the only guy that did it three times. So that's the, you know, the, I mean, that's a pretty impressive list of characters.
Yeah, those, and sure. those would be four guys you would say, okay, of course they're on the list, right?
But then we have Pat Regan. I mean, the only thing he did in his career was pitch an immaculate inning. you know, an interesting guy too, but there's an opportunity for a story. So how he pitched his immaculate inning was unique. This is early part of the 20th century. He goes up, he throws a strike, he takes off his cap, and he waves to the crowd. And nobody's really clapping or anything. What is this guy doing? Throws another strike, does the same thing again. By the eighth time, everybody's clapping and cheering. They're right into it, right? But then I think he figured, geez, I think something really special is happening here. I better knuckle down. He didn't tip his hat on the final one. I think he just got off. One of the challenges was I anticipated that there could be entries where you've got one sentence on the immaculate inning. And I guess that was part of what motivated me to look deeper and talk about the pitcher and focus on the story of the pitcher. So what I really tried to do was capture something about that pitcher, whether related specifically to the game or something outside of the game, that I simply thought would be entertaining. And that was really the motivation. I mean, Pat Regan was definitely a funny one. Rube Waddell, you know, probably had autism or ADHD. There's great stories about him, you know, being late for a game because he stopped to play marbles with a bunch of kids on the way into the stadium. Dazzy Vance, again, a very well-known pitcher, I mean, another great one, but I love the story about how he used to slit his undershirt. I don't know if you know this one or not. He used to slit his undershirt so he'd have flaps. And when he was pitching, and he pitching at Ebbett Field, on that one corner where everybody used to hang their laundry and everything, he said this gave him an advantage because as he was throwing it, was distracting.
Flash of white, right?
Flash of white, you know, things like that were great. I love the Milt Pappas story. Milt Pappas has so many great stories. I mean, one of my favorites is when Roger Maris was chasing the home run record, and Milt was upset that who was it? Was it Fick at the time? Who was going to put an asterisk beside his record? And he went up to Maris the night before a game, and he said, "I'm going to throw you nothing but fastballs right down the middle." And Mickey Mantle was standing there, and he said, "What am I going to get?" And he said, "You're on your own, big boy." But you know, great things like that. He's a wonderful story about how you know, he was chasing a perfect game. Really, almost got right to the end, and then had four balls. Really rather questionable calls on him, blew his perfect game. The ump the next day, I'm blocking on his name, but the ump the next day came up to him with a ball and asked him to sign it. And he said, sure. He picked it, signed it, and then he told him where he could put it. And it would have been really anatomically difficult to do it, actually. But, you look at Sandy Koufax, right? I mean, he's got one of the most beautiful deliveries I've ever seen, one of the most unusual ones. I think that's one of the reasons why no one could hit Sandy Koufax, because he had that overarm exaggerated catapult that almost would look like a windmill in some respects, and they just couldn't read it. You know, great hitters talking about, you know, they knew what he was going to throw, but they couldn't hit it. I mean, he was terrible at giving away when he was going to throw a fastball. But the angle and the trajectory was so unusual that it was just, and he pitched three. So, you know, maybe there's something to that. One of the things that's interesting is you get the greats, but there are a lot of greats that never did pitch an immaculate inning too. It's one of the things I think that makes it interesting is you've got nobodies alongside Hall of Fame pitchers. You know, I think it's one of the big differences between a perfect game and a perfect inning. I mean, you pretty much know the outcome when it's a perfect game.
Yeah.
We all know about the cases where it's been blown on the 27th batter and those kinds of things. But it's something can be easily missed. And that sort of part of it to me makes it, that's one of the reasons for the book, I think. Let's start the dialogue on how important an immaculate inning actually is and see if it matters.
Thank you very much, John. That was fantastic.
Thanks very much for having me.
Okay, bookworms, we got to take a quick break, so get comfy and we'll be right back. Hey, everybody, it's time for the weekly pitch plug. Thanks again for supporting Pitch Talks and making our next show at the Phoenix Concert Theater in Toronto completely sold out. There's another Pitch Talks coming up, and that's on April 28th in Tavistock, Ontario, so come on down. Meanwhile, we've got three Puck Talks on the books. Toronto on March 23rd, Ottawa on March 24th, and Brooklyn on March 28th. For tickets and info on these shows, and all of our other world domination plans, swing on over to homestandsports.gov. Welcome back to Pitch Talks and our looks at books. You can never accuse Jonah Carey, from amongst other things, the Jonah Carey podcast, of forgetting his roots. Born and raised in Montreal, Carey has been a Montreal Expos freak since he was a kid. And much like his boyhood team of choice, he also made the move to the U.S. for better prospects. Years later, after the Expos were just a distant memory and Carey had already published one book on baseball, titled The Extra 2%, he was asked to write a follow-up book. He knew there could only be one topic for that book, the Montreal Expos. Recorded live at Pitch Talks, Carey gives us a look at exactly what went into writing the definitive book on the team, the modestly titled Up, Up, and Away, The Kid, The Hawk, Rock, Vladdy, Pedro, Le Grand Orange, Yuppie, The Crazy Business of Baseball, and the ill-fated but unforgettable Montreal Expos. Quick note here, the audio gets a little murky in a few spots, but hang in there, it is worth it.
Who's the expo that, you know, you wrote the book, you did a million interviews, you met a bunch of people. Who was there one that you were just a 12-year-old again when, more than any other one?
Well, Raines. Yeah. I mean, I was younger with Raines and with the net. Like, I was a big Larry Walker, huge Larry Walker fan, but Larry Walker came of age when I was like, 18, whatever, 17, I don't know. So Raines, his rookie season, that great rookie season in 81, I was six. And so this is my first memory. And I'd met him before. And, like, I exaggerated and I joke about it on Twitter or whatever. Like, I know the guy. We're friendly at this point. But to have him open up like that, to just – he was managing the Newark Bears at the time. So I went to downtown Newark. Don't do that. That's a bad idea. But I did. And the stadium was desolate, whatever. And Ron Karkovice was one of the coaches. Like, it was just like a wall of 80s baseball players were all the staff. It was great. And he's sitting in his office. This was very unglamorous, I suppose. He's sitting like this. He's got his belt unbuckled, and he says, yeah, come on in, let's talk. Which was like a little informal, like for a guy that you idolize when you were six, but okay. And it was great. And he talked for like an hour and a half. And I asked him, you know, I'm trying to be a real journalist, so I'm asking about the cocaine stuff, and I'm asking about the tough times. And 82 was rough for him, you know? He didn't whatever, everybody used coke at the time, but he was like, his life was spiraling out of control, was bad. Reigns was emotional about it, you know what I mean? Like, he felt bad. He felt like he was going to potentially piss away his career, and Dawson ended up taking him under his wing or whatever. So it ended up, honestly, as a journalist, being a rewarding thing just because he opened up so much. And I think that a lot of people did from the team, and part of that's what happens when you talk to people who are not... You know what I mean? If you talk to Jose Bautista 20 years from now, I bet that'll be fascinating. He's going to give you much more than he would now because he can't talk about certain things, whether it's squabbles with teammates, whether it's off-field stuff, whatever. These guys have nothing to lose. The franchise doesn't exist. They all retired years, sometimes decades ago. You know, they have exhibition games at the Big O. They had an event, like a gala, which they have every year, and they put me at the head table. So I was sitting between Reigns and the mayor. No, I'm sorry, Dawson and the mayor. Across from me was Vladdy, Reigns, Andres Galarraga, and Warren Cromartie. And I was like, what is going on right now? And it was great. And they made me give the speech for, you know, to just like invite Reigns on stage. And I got a little emotional, whatever. And I did the whole thing and whatever. And he comes up and he hugs me and he goes, thank you for everything that you've done. I was like, oh, that's because he knows that I'm a lunatic. And so that's, for better or for worse, what our relationship is, where, you know, we treat each other like peers, but I still have this reverence for this guy who's just a guy and, you know, he has the same issues and whatever. The best thing at the gala was I was in the middle of a conversation, I think, with Dawson, and he stops me and he goes, how's it going with the twins? He has twins who are like the same age as my twins. So we talked about like poopy diapers, and I was just like, oh, this is an interesting conversation I'm having with my childhood hero, whatever.
Yeah, I mean, my favorite stuff was all just researching the book. It was like collecting baseball cards, but they're people and they're having breakfast with you. It was unbelievable. And one that I really liked was Cliff Floyd. This is good, actually. So I'm supposed to meet Cliff Floyd for breakfast in Miami, and I'm bad about being on time. But if it's like socially or whatever, but if it's an interview, I try really hard. And I get on, I'm on time, and I'm waiting. And he's like 20 minutes, 25 minutes. Finally, half an hour later, he shows up in a Bentley, and I'm like, oh, okay, this is what it's going to be like. That he's late. He's half an hour late. He shows up in a Bentley. Fine. Comes up, whatever, and I'm kind of, I don't want to have a bias against this guy, but it's hard not to because whatever, and he comes in and he apologizes profusely, and we sit down, and for 2.5 hours, we sit in a coffee shop, and he's telling these stories that are unreal, and not like rowdy stories or whatever, but like these personal stories. He was a rookie in 94, 95, he had a horrible accident where this guy's running down the first baseline, he goes to tag him and his wrist turns like 180 degrees, that's not how wrists work, and just this horrible, painful injury. He's like a 21-year-old guy, and he's telling this story, we're totally surrounded, we're just in the middle of this busy coffee shop, and he's crying, and I'm crying, and people can overhear us, and they're crying about his rehab, and how he worked an infinitesimal, and like everything was like a millimeter this, and it was like, he didn't know if he'd be able to use his arm again, I mean, it was that bad, and just going through the process, and rehabbing, and rehabbing, and rehabbing, and finally he's telling the story of him coming back, and just making it all back, and he's in tears, and he's talking about his physical therapist, and all this stuff, and it stuck with me, it was very poignant.
I talked to over 130 people for the book, and my favorite interview by a comfortable margin was Felipe Alou. It took me a while to track him down. I had to go through the Giants. They were no help. I found him, and he had a bad head cold when we talked that day. But he said, we're doing it. You know, that's fine. We talked for an hour. And honestly, we talked, there was some very detailed baseball stuff. We talked a lot about Pedro Martinez and Vladimir Guerrero in particular, and what you need to do to get the best out of those guys. In the case of Guerrero, nothing. Literally leave him alone. He's a freak of nature. Just let him do his thing, and he was right. And he talked about Pedro, and Pedro said that Felipe is his guy. He would not have been where he was without Pedro. But what most resonated with me about the talk with Felipe was that we talked about religion and spirituality and the value of family. And I'm not very religious, and I'm not very spiritual, and I don't know. It's not my wheelhouse necessarily, but I was basically crying while I was talking to this guy. It was unbelievable. He was talking about how proud he was of the Alou name, that it was now known worldwide, and what it had meant to be a spiritual person, to experience this stuff and to get to where he was, and the how many years, 20 odd years that he spent in the minor league system being buried for no other reason than the color of his skin before he finally got the goddamn job that he deserved and turned out to be a genius of a manager. And it was unbelievable. I just have never experienced anything like that. I've never had any interview in my whole career. I've been a journalist for 20 odd years. Never had anything like that. Never had it with the book. Might go to my grave and I will not have experienced more profound emotions talking to anybody than I did in that hour with Felipe Alou.
Felipe Alou is Yoda. There is no other way to say it. First of all, he's the cutest. But I mean, it's just, he is, I wish he was my grandfather. Like, he's so awesome. We sat there. You could tell he was a real loyal guy, but he's telling me things about his family, about how proud it made him that he had accomplished something. He was kind of the first of a generation, and then in Dominican, the Alou name meant something. And a couple generations before, it meant that they were farmers, that they were dirt poor, that they slept in a shack, that it was nothing, and that he had spearheaded this thing where it had become this high family in the Dominican. And even he had a cousin who was in Spain, and they knew of the Alous in Spain, that he had made this thing where the legacy of his family was going to go on because he was a good player, but also because he was a good manager and because he was a good man. And I was just, I don't think I've ever learned more in 1 hour in my life than I did talking to Felipe Alou. And honestly, if I never wrote anything after all these interviews and I just had that experience, those would have been the best 3 years I ever had. So that was it for me.
On August 22nd, 2008, I signed a book contract to write a book called The Extra 2%. And it was about the Tampa Bay Rays. And I followed the Rays closely, and I got to know all these people within the organization, and very interesting team. They did very well. The book did really, really well, and it led to other things. The job that I have at Granlin now, and that largely came from that book. The Expos book, the Up, Up, and Away, pretty much came from that book, too. It all happened from that book, and that's all great professionally, and the Rays are an interesting team, blah, 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 blah. That's not the real reason. The real reason I signed that contract on August 22nd, 2008, is because I'm a curse, you see. When I write about things and when I say things, exactly the opposite happens. And so this was a long con 7 years ago that I was going to go write about the Tampa Bay Rays, then they would have stadium difficulties, then there would be momentum, then there would be the Montreal Baseball Project, and then we would have baseball back in Montreal. That is the story.
That's Jonah Carey on his book on the history of the Expos, Up, Up, and Away. There are links to each of the books we talked about on the podcast found in the show notes. And if those three books weren't enough for you, Sportsnet's Ben Nicholson-Smith and the Arkell's Nick Ditka each have recommendations for you. Fellas?
Big Data Baseball by Travis Stoshek is a good one. Really good read. I like books in that vein. Very analytical, almost a new take on Moneyball. Even baseball fiction, which I was surprised, but there's this book called The Art of Fielding by Chad Harbaugh. Very good read. So anyone looking for some baseball fiction, good read.
Field of Schemes, which is about publicly funding stadiums. They kind of illuminate a lot of like interesting things about the business of stadiums and baseball that you might not be aware of if you haven't thought about it too closely.
Well, that's it for Pitch Talks this week. Hope you enjoyed our little book club. Thank you for your continued support of the podcast and for coming out to our live shows. For more info and tickets on those live shows, other podcasts, videos, and more, skip on over to homestandsports.com/pitch and all will be revealed. And if you have the time, please leave some feedback for this podcast on iTunes. Every little bit of love you give us helps. And you can follow us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram, where we are known simply as Pitch Talks. Finally, email all questions and kudos to podcasts@homestandsports.com. I'm Kevin Hilliard. Good night, everybody. The Pitch Talks love theme by Steve Kreklow, @KRECKLO on Twitter. Additional music by Steve Kreklow and Kevin McLeod at incompetech.com. incompetech.com. Pitch Talks is a Homestand Sports production.